where the dust hangs high, far from a river where things grow green, the flowers weep and they lean away from the blood-stained soil beneath my feet. The thorns outnumber the petals on the rose, and the darkness amplifies the sound of printer's ink on propaganda page that will rule your life and fuel my rage.
That was Terrence Bobby with As Yet Untitled, in tribute to an icon of the civil rights movement, Lawrence Guyot, who, with Fannie Lou Hamer, started the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party. Lawrence Guyot died last Friday morning after a long illness. He was 73 years old. He was a guest on this program on October the 24th. In fact, on the day he did the show, he had just come back from dialysis treatment and was weak, but he insisted that we go ahead. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It's Monday, November the 26th. And although all hell is breaking loose in Cairo, after the much vaunted triumph of Hillary Clinton's fast and furious Israel-Hamas peace accord, and you know what happened there, all is quiet, eerily quiet, at the State Department. We'll talk about that in a bit, but first, let's revisit with Lawrence Guyot, and he's here talking about a triumph of the grassroots activism that he was involved in with Fannie Lou Hamer, and that was the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party. A word from the late Lawrence Guyot. We talked with each other, Mr. Guyot, but I bid you a very warm welcome to Lead Stories today.
Well, I feel very welcome, and I feel very honored to have been associated by you in your memories of where we are today.
Yes, indeed.
We both should be very, very proud of what we've contributed to this country.
Well, thank you. Let's start with something so poignant, and I'm glad to ask you to start with it, and that is with that great lady with whom you were associated, Ms. Fannie Lou Hamer.
Fannie Lou Hamer, a sixth grade educated woman who was a political and religious genius. Fannie Lou Hamer was a religious fanatic, and I say that in the most positive sense. She really felt that you were supposed to go out and feed the hungry, clothe the naked, visit those who are bound. She put it in stark terms. She said, if I allow myself to hate people, I will never see the face of Jesus. So here's a woman who really felt that she was exercising her religious beliefs by getting involved in the practical body of politics. And I've used her example to preach that the meaning of her life forever. I simplify it this way. If and when you begin to talk about feeding the hungry, clothe the naked, visit those who are bound, you must enter into the political arena. There's no other way to do it. I maintain that a practicing religious person who is not also a practicing political individual is not doing either of those very well. Now, what impact did Fannie Lou Hamer have? In fact, Fannie Lou Hamer gave a short speech at the Democratic National Convention that Lyndon Johnson did everything he could to stop. But at that time, we were only dealing with three stations nationally, NBC, ABC, and CBS. They all taped her speech, and they all delivered it in its entirety that evening on the half an hour national. Now, I take you back now when I said the half an hour national news. The country was electrified. See this woman. Then Lyndon Johnson said, but we can't have a floor fight that we're going to lose about seating an all-white delegation from Mississippi and then go and ask blacks to vote for us as Democrats, as President of the United States, and Vice President of the United States. So, of course, all I would do is I would urge all listeners to go back to the Lyndon Johnson tapes. He lays all of this out. So what we had was a group of people organized by students that was made up of ministers, lawyers, very few lawyers, field hands, beauticians, and cotton pickers, taking on the President of the United States and forcing the battle to such a point that we beat everyone in Atlantic City except Lyndon Johnson. So the point of all of this is this leads to a position of two things. Number one, we're going to open up the Democratic selection process, and that's the only way it got open. Number two, we're going to modify it so that blacks have to be involved, and the agreement is there will never be another segregated delegation seated ever again. There never has been one. 1972, that rule gets modified to say very precisely that 50% of all state delegations must now be female. What we did was opened up the political process from in a state that was considered the most vicious of all states. Mississippi's position was there would be no black registration. You want to register to vote, we will post your name in the local newspaper the day that you register. It will run for 20 days. In that time, if you owe white people money, they want it. If you work for them, you'll be fired. If you rent for them, you'll be kicked out. So people look at this and say, well, how could you have the most repressive state government and have, at the same time, in its midst, have the most creative civil rights movement in American history? Well, let's look at it. What we relied on was the memory and the resilience of black people in Mississippi. They, by their churches, by their customs, by their fraternities and sororities, they had maintained a vibrant society that was hostile to whites, and that was really whites felt hostile too, but yet survived. It is amazing to me that there was a recent Supreme Court decision in Israel to allow Palestinians to use highways. Mississippi never went that far. So it is very important that we understand Mississippi was a southern state ignoring the 15th Amendment, and as it, because of its ignorance of its totally ignoring the 15th Amendment, it maintained a lot of seniority. The Democratic Party was chairman of every committee, major committee in the House of Representatives and the Senate. Why? Because there was no Republican Party in the South. The Republican Party did not emerge in the South until 1964. In 1964, the Republican Party did two things. It kicked all black delegates out of the convention at San Francisco. And it backed a man named Goldwater, who wanted to do away with Social Security and that kind of stuff, and who really was the father of the right-wing takeover of the Republican Party and of the Southern strategy. But what The beauty of what the Freedom Democratic Party stood for, it took the existing avenues we had, either in the Constitution or on the streets, or created out of the churches, and we combined all of that, and we turned it into a kind of political activism that was issue-oriented, that was action-inducing, that was everything that we did either was done to provoke, challenge, or provide example to political empowerment. We felt clearly that political empowerment was about transformation.
I tried to bend my knees, but my knees were already bent. I haven't stood like a man for such a long time now. I called on my God, but he was sleeping on that day. I guess I'll just have to depend on me. Shall I tell my children if they ask of me? Did I surrender forth my right to be? You see, my daddy died to leave this haunting ground, and this same ground still haunts me. The cool September blows the seeds away. The harvest's blown again this year, but I'll return a stronger man. I'll return to me, my homeland. No grave shall hold my body down. This land is still mine.
Thank you. That's Terence Trent D'Arby with a very poignant number called As Yet Untitled. Well, if you've been following things, you see that after a lot of brouhaha, there's a lot of silence. It's so odd. Very, very odd. Because the person in question that I'm going to be talking about is a person who likes attention, who is always looking for it. In fact, that's why during the beginnings of the Southeast Asian tour with the president, one had expected that she would be in the Middle East brokering. But she gave enough time for the folks that had to deal with it, including Egyptian President Morsi, to kind of get it together and work out something with the Palestinian and Arab side, so that by the time she shows up, the work would have been done, essentially, to bring the Arabs, to get them to behave, which is really the big thing. Why can't these folks behave and just... No, just lay down and take whatever is coming at them. Just behave. It's like what the educational system really requires most of African American and Latino students. It's not so much that they should achieve. Most importantly, just kind of be quiet. You know, we don't care if you learn, just behave. and be grateful. But anyway, where we left off with Susan Rice definitively explaining what the situation was, literally having to go to bat for herself because it was clear that she was being eaten alive, including, by the way, by her peers. One would have expected that being one of only a few women on in the president's cabinet, they expected all the other sisters to come forward and say, hey, we're not going to have you guys trounce this woman like that. She's my fellow cabinet member. And certainly one would have expected it of Hillary Clinton, considering that their jobs are pretty closely connected. But Susan Rice made a very telling statement consisting of about seven words. When she explained herself, she said, "I agreed to a White House request." That's how she started. And that told the whole story right there. I agreed to a White House request. What does that mean? Well, if you're functioning within the capacity of your job description, you don't have to be requested to do anything. It's understood that that's what comes with it. It comes with your job description. So the mere fact she said, I agreed to a request, it means not only was it whatever it is that was requested was clearly outside of her normal jurisdiction, and number two, it probably was something that she particularly would have some trouble with, but she agreed to it. And it's like if you are working in a diner as a person who meets and greets the public and seats the public, and then the short order cook just kind of storms off, and next thing you know, the owner comes and tells you, hey, put on an apron and go back there and scramble some eggs. Same thing. But that very act itself has to be interpreted very, very carefully. She did not say the president. She said, I agreed to a White House request. Well, why? Why did the White House have to request anything of you? You're not an understudy for Hillary Clinton. You're not a stand-in. You're not her assistant. You're not her deputy. You are a cabinet member on equal standing with Hillary Clinton. So why wasn't Hillary Clinton available to do the job that is well within her job description? And who was it who requested something of you? Well, I just want to refresh our memory a bit, and we'll go to this interview that Hillary Clinton had with Margaret Brennan in Lima, Peru, shortly after she got there, on diplomatic business. While the Führer was at home, Margaret Brennan caught up with her. This was the report that aired on CBS TV's This Morning program with Charlie Rose.
Hillary Clinton is speaking in depth about the killing of American ambassador to Libya, Christopher Stevens.
During a round of interviews last night, Clinton said she was responsible for the ambassador's security, not the White House. And Margaret Brennan spoke with the secretary overnight in Lima, Peru.
Good morning. On her first overseas trip since the fatal attack on the U.S. consulate in Libya, Secretary Clinton is trying to set the record straight, pushing back against what some are calling mixed messages out of Washington.
On September 16th, Ambassador Susan Rice made a number of TV appearances. Did you approve her speaking points that she delivered on the TV shows that day?
I think she very clearly said, here's what we know now, but this is going to change. This is what we have at present, but it will evolve, and the intelligence community has said the same thing.
Just 5 days after the attack, Rice appeared on CBS's Face the Nation. She blamed the violence on spontaneous protests over an anti-Muslim film.
We do not have information at present that leads us to conclude that this was premeditated or pre-planned.
Who briefed Ambassador Rice that day? Did you sign off on that briefing and those speaking points?
You would have to ask her.
You didn't speak to her before that appearance?
No, but that does. Everybody had the same information. I mean, I have to say, I know there's been a lot of attention paid to who said what when, but I think what happened is more important. We were attacked, and four brave Americans were killed. Everybody in the administration had, you know, has tried to say what we knew at the time with the caveat that we would learn more, and that's what's happened. So I think that I've seen it before, not just in respect to this. I think it's part of what the fog of war causes.
Over time, the Obama administration changed the reason behind the attacks, calling it a planned terrorist assault, citing evolving intelligence, fueling Republican charges of a political cover-up.
Either they are misleading the American people or incredibly incompetent.
It came up again at last week's vice presidential debate.
At the time, we were told exactly, we said exactly what the intelligence community told us that they knew. That was the assessment. And as the intelligence community changed their view, we made it clear they changed their view.
Clinton has said the responsibility ends with the State Department.
I'm not going to get into the blame game. I think intelligence is very hard to do. And what we're going to find out as we do this accountability review and we get what will be the best possible chronology that will be attached to what we knew when, which takes time. I understand the anxiety and the desire to try to get answers. Nobody wants to get answers more than I do.
Ambassador Rice's spokesperson tells CBS that she was given those speaking points by the intelligence community, not Clinton's State Department. Last night, three Republican senators released a statement praising Clinton for taking responsibility, but saying the security of Americans is ultimately the responsibility of the president. For CBS This Morning, Margaret Brennan, Lima, Peru.
Okay. Well, we heard that, and we've heard versions of that before, but it was good to be refreshed, to have our memory refreshed by Mrs. Clinton, giving her explanation as to what happened. You notice when the reporter asked, did you approve the speaking points? She never answered the question. She didn't say yes or no. She didn't answer it at all. But she did say, no, I did not speak to her. When she was asked the following question, did you speak to her? Look, let me be clear about something. This is not about whether they used the word terrorist or whether they used the word, protest, or whether they used it as, the verbiage of the so-called talking point is not the issue. But it is a very convenient way to have Mrs. Clinton do a typical Clinton move, which is you wiggle out and you get people talking about issues that are really not important in the scheme of things, certainly not as important as the huge issue, which is four Americans were killed, were murdered as a result of somebody not doing their job. Now, in the scheme of things, here's where they have shifted this. By the way, Hillary Clinton came out and said, I am responsible. And nobody wants to let her be responsible. John McCain, the guy who is just waiting to you know, just squeeze Obama's neck, himself has said, no, we won't accept the apology from Hillary Clinton. And here, the brave feminist is all too happy to fade into the damsel in distress thing of, well, you know, I've said it, but nobody wants to hold me be responsible. So, you know, what can I do? I've said I'm responsible. Even the president says I'm not responsible. She is responsible. And in the meantime, they've dragged out Susan Rice to take the blunt force trauma here. Now, what concerns me, it's not the language and not all of that. You know, that's just a way of the opposition picking little things. The big thing is how clearly Mrs. Clinton has already shifted out of focus. She's already, you know, she's already gone through the curtains on this one, and has left everybody arguing about whether it is a racist attack on Susan Rice or a sexist attack on Susan Rice. No, it's not about Susan Rice. For the first time, I think when you look at this, you see clear evidence. And it's a troubling thing about Barack Obama. And what is troubling is it seems really clear to me that this particular president has literally been surrounded by the Clintonites who do business in a whole different way. Nobody needs to know, well, who did they know? It is insulting for Joe Biden to come out and say, well, you know, we said what we knew at the time. Don't say this garbage anymore. People are smarter than that. You're supposed to have the most sophisticated intelligence gathering apparatus in the world. All hell is breaking loose. And according to accounts, for at least 6 hours, and there's no response. So don't tell me about you didn't know or when did they know, and we now need an inquiry to find out who knew what and when. No. We don't need any of that. Don't try this one. The United States intelligence gathering apparatus literally functions on a microsecond level. They know from minute to minute to minute what is going on. And you can't tell me that somebody posted in a hotbed of protest where they had just assassinated the leader with the assistance of the U.S. government. And you send your ambassador into that environment, and it doesn't occur to you that somehow or the other, it might be a touchy situation in terms of safety. Mrs. Clinton wasn't going to go there to live and work. You know, the president is not going to go there to live and work. Why would you send an ambassador? Why would you send a diplomatic employees in an environment like that, expecting that, you know, it was just as usual, no big deal. But here's where I think we need to focus. What we see coming to light, and it is so blatant, is that this is a classic Clinton tale of how the Clintons, because they were co-presidents of the United States, how the Clintons dealt with terrorism, especially terrorism aimed at U.S. personnel and U.S. diplomatic offices abroad. I did some research and I came up with a fascinating bit. from a writer, Byron York, who at the time was writing for the National Review. And he makes some interesting notations here. And this goes back to 2001. He wrote this article. I tried reaching him. Hopefully we'll get him on shortly. June 25th, 1996, a powerful truck bomb explodes outside of Khobar Towers barracks in Dahran, Saudi Arabia, killing 19 American soldiers and hundreds more injured. In this article, he says, the first thing, what do you think the first thing that... The first thing that Clinton does, he says, is speak to his top political strategist, Dick Morris. And Dick Morris, well, you know, he's always on the Fox Network saying, you know, he was the one who predicted an astounding victory for Mitt Romney. But at the time, Dick was very, very close to Bill Clinton. And he was a guy who was, you know, he was like Clinton, what Axelrod is to Obama. And immediately, now a major tragedy has occurred, right? 19 American soldiers, 19 killed, hundreds more injured. Dick Morris, the first thing he does is conduct a poll. I know. Conduct a poll. Why? Because depending on what the poll said, because Clinton was in the midst of his political campaign, depending on what the poll said, they would fashion a response or an answer, a public answer to suit. And Dick Morris writes, he says that I was concerned about how Clinton looked in the face of the attack and whether people would blame him. Whenever there was a crisis, I ordered an immediate poll. You see elements of this. This is a Clinton way. And he did too. Just in case, so he can get a more accurate reading. And the poll, he said, we tested two alternative defenses to this attack. In other words, he was preparing Clinton to take one of two positions, depending on how it was going to go. And he writes in his book, they went after one thing called strategy called the peacemaker defense. And in the peacemaker defense, he was going to position Clinton as a peacemaker who brought the Arabs and Israelis in Ireland and Bosnia, secured a ceasefire in Bosnia, and used his strength to bring about peace. I remind you, there are dead soldiers. There are 19 dead soldiers. And they're busy strategizing about how to position the president. How you position this so that you don't jeopardize his political fortunes. So Clinton could either be positioned as the peacemaker or he could be positioned as the tough guy, depending on how the poll turned out, and they determined that he would be positioned as the tough guy because the numbers said that the public preferred toughness. Now, this is written in 2001. Okay. So he says, and the report says, so Clinton talked tough, but he did not act tough. The February 26, 1993 bombing of the World Trade Center the Khobar Towers attack, the August 7th, 1998 bombing of U.S. embassies in Kenya and Tanzania, and the October 12th, 2000 attack on the USS Cole, Clinton was preoccupied with his own political fortunes to an extent that precluded his giving serious and sustained attention to fighting terrorism. Now, similarly, Barack Obama is running. And literally, this occurs just at a time when the race was so tight. The race was so tight. Every vote counted. They were watching everything. There is a Clinton in the picture. Two of them, actually. Bill Clinton never left the White House. He believed him. He believed Barack Obama was his proxy. And so it is quite possible, I would argue, that this was part of the consideration. Whether it was this word or that word, the idea was, how would the event, this incident, this horrible murder of four American citizens, including an ambassador, how would it affect the outcome of the election? And so words were selected accordingly. It was in Bill Clinton's administration that the country first learned that there was an Osama bin Laden, because the first attack on the World Trade Center occurred in the Clinton administration. The Clinton administration was the first time we heard of Al-Qaeda. The first time. Here's what this writer says. Clinton had been in office just 38 days when terrorists bombed the World Trade Center, killing six people and injuring more than 1,000. He warned Americans against overreacting, and in an interview on MTV, described the bombing as the work of someone, quote, who did something really stupid, unquote. This is from the president. Now, does that sound like presidential language to you? In the same way, does it sound logical to you that we are fighting over words of whether we call it an incident or whether we use the word terrorism? You see, the same thing is going on. He says, from the start, Clinton approached the investigation as a law enforcement issue. And guess what? Because it was a law enforcement issue, the FBI took hold of the information. Local law enforcement prevailed. They put a clamp on all of the information, didn't share it with anybody else. Sounds familiar? They didn't share it with, if it were a terrorist attack, which Clinton did not say, if it were the first attack on the World Trade Center, if they had described it as a terrorist attack, then they would have had to call in the CIA and so forth, and you would have to use the word terrorism. But he calls it somebody who did something stupid. My goodness, I'm reading this and I'm going to my, but this is really, really very similar scenarios that we have here. Now let's get to the embassies in particular. On August 7th, 1998, there were two simultaneous bombings of U.S. embassies, one in Nairobi, Kenya, and the other in Dar es Salaam in Tanzania. More than 200 people, in fact, this it was somewhere like 258 people, were killed, including 12 Americans. Including 12 Americans. Clinton decided he would not pursue this outright as a terrorist attack. But what he did do was that he ordered cruise missile strikes on bin Laden's camp in Afghanistan and blew up a pharmaceutical plant in Sudan that he said was making weapons of mass destruction or biological warfare and other allegations, which turned out not to be true. But Clinton did not pursue even those attacks that were so deadly, all those body bags coming back home, as a terrorist attack. That was really odd. Here's a quote. "Everyone knew that this was a wag the dog charge," meaning that Clinton at the time was a little preoccupied. And he was occupied because he was under investigation for the Monica Lewinsky affair. And so even the attacks on U.S. consulates in Dar es Salaam and in Nairobi that were so devastating, claiming all those lives, it was not immediately said it was a terrorist attack. It was not said it was a terrorist attack. So what we find is that the president was in the middle of, when I say the president, I mean Clinton at the time. What was important, because he was embroiled in investigations, he was embroiled in all kinds of an internal blockage between the FBI and the CIA, people are not talking to each other. But more than anything, he was obsessed about the PR impact. How would this affect his profile? And you will note that during the Clinton administration, there were no so-called reprisals. Nobody was hunted down and found and just brought to justice and all this kind of stuff. We did have some arrests, but that was only after, according to this reporter, a senior level administration member in the intelligence community, as they're calling it now, literally went to the former president, George H.W. Bush, and asked George H.W. Bush to intercede and help them get access and cooperation from Saudi Arabia and from the other places where the attacks occurred. That was how little the Clinton administration had pursued the matter of terrorism against U.S. diplomats. The reporter writes, "He seemed more concerned that the attacks might threaten the administration's work," meaning the work in the Middle East. Could you imagine that? He was more obsessed about that because his work in the Middle East, the bringing about the peace process, was supposed to be the crowning glory of the Clinton administration. Hello, hello, are you listening? And who just went and did a fast and furious thing to wrap up a big triumph in the Middle East so that she can sail out on a high note and it would be a wonderful platform to launch herself into orbit come 2016. "I have brokered a peace between Israel and Hamas." The Barack Obama administration troubles me in this regard because we see these parallels and they're very disturbing. They're disturbing because you wonder who is making the decision at the White House. Who is making the calls? Who is making the decision for the president? The president himself had gone to the General Assembly. I played the tape right here and insisted that what was going on was that you had a problem unfolding in the Middle East because of a movie. That's what he said. And it is not a crazy thing that the Republicans are upset about it. Of course, they're looking for any reason to punch a hole in the new Obama administration's second term. And I understand that. But they also have a very important point. The question isn't about the wording. The question is, did this administration, for the sake of PR, just the way Bill Clinton used it, just the same way that Bill Clinton operated, is this administration manipulating public knowledge and even the knowledge within the administration itself so as to not lose ground politically? This is a very serious question, because lives have been lost. We know that emails were flying back and forth. You can't tell me, you have embassies all over the world. You get minute-by-minute accounts all day long. I played a tape of you for you to hear Condoleezza Rice, former Secretary of State, talk about, literally, it's heavy traffic every day. And they do have these ultra secret communication systems where literally in an instant the so-called intelligence community, and it is a community, would know that something disastrous was happening. So you can't tell me that this is a matter of, well, it was a protest that burgeoned into... Look, I saw a tape, and I want to see if I could get an English translation. A Libyan photographer was actually interviewing Ambassador Stevens, asking him specifically, was he concerned about his security? She asked him three different versions of the same question. She pointed out about the protests. She pointed out about anti-American sentiments. And she was asking, are you comfortable in this environment? How do you cope with being in this environment? And that's just a reporter. Imagine if you are in the intelligence community. You ought to know. Hillary Clinton knows, and this is why she's not speaking, because she anticipates when she's called before this accountability review board, which they now look upon as a kind of, it's a process. It's now a process to study. Lives have been lost. And they're talking about a process so we can, you know, shape up our operations a little tighter and so forth and so forth. Yes, we're sorry that people died and so forth, but now we have an opportunity to put things in place and whatnot. I'm going to stay on this because there is something that stinks here, and I think we're getting close to it. I think we need to ask Barack Obama a whole bunch of questions here. And we're beginning to see how far the Clinton method of operating has even affected our president, our current president. Bill Clinton never left the White House, and Hillary Clinton is his insurance. They've got plans. And Barack Obama did not respond, his administration, I should say, did not respond and is not responding the way you would expect a new way of thinking would inform him to respond. This is very troubling. This is very troubling. Imagine this. people are dead, and the first thing your advisor does is wonder how it would portray you in the public eye, and commissions a poll. You've got to be kidding me. I will leave it there for today. We're coming back to this tomorrow. I want you to take a look at how things are moving. Don't pay attention to all this fight with Susan Rice. I mean, that's a non-issue, really. It really is. It's instructive in the way people operate, but in the scheme of things, the bigger picture is at hand. It's at hand. We're getting close to it. We'll talk again tomorrow. Thank you so much.
I'll buy a shanty where the dust hangs high, far from a river where things grow green, the flowers weep and they leave.